Welcome to the conclusion of A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce. This is the latter part of Chapter 5, Part 7 in our series. But if this is your introduction to my readings, check out Liberty Lit on audio and at community.livejournal.com/libertylit, where I'm also reading Ulysses by James Joyce. Towards dawn he awoke. Oh, what sweet music! His soul was all dewy wet. Over his limbs in sleep, pale cool waves of light had passed. He lay still, as if his soul lay amid cool waters, conscious of a faint, sweet music. His mind was walking slowly to a tremulous morning knowledge, a morning inspiration. A spirit filled him, pure as the purest water, sweet as dew, moving as music. But how faintly it was inbreathed, how passionlessly, as if the seraphim themselves were breathing upon him. His soul was waking slowly, fearing to awake wholly. It was that windless hour of dawn, when madness wakes, and strange plants open to the light, and the moth flies forth silently. An enchantment of the heart. The night had been enchanted. In a dream or vision he had known the ecstasy of seraphic life. Was it an instant of enchantment only, or long hours and days and years and ages? The instant of inspiration seemed now to be reflected, from all sides at once, from a multitude of cloudy circumstance, of what had happened or of what might have happened. The instant flashed forth like a point of light, and now from cloud on cloud of vague circumstance, confused form was veiling softly its afterglow. Oh! In the virgin womb of the imagination, the Word was made flesh. Gabriel the Seraph had come to the Virgin's chamber. An afterglow deepened within his spirit, whence the white flame had passed, deepening to a rose and ardent light. That rose and ardent light was her strange, wilful heart, strange that no man had known or would know, wilful from before the beginning of the world, and lured by that ardent rose-like glow the choirs of the seraphim were falling from heaven. Are you not weary of ardent ways, lure of the fallen seraphim? Tell no more of enchanted days. The verses passed from his mind to his lips, and murmuring them over he felt the rhythmic movement of a villanelle pass through them. The rose-like glow sent forth its rays of rhyme, ways, days, blaze, praise, rays. His rays burned up the world, consumed the hearts of men and angels, the rays from the rose that was her wilful heart. Your eyes have set man's heart ablaze, and you have had your will of him. Are you not weary of ardent ways? And then the rhythm died away, ceased, began again to move and beat, and then smoke, incense according from the altar of the world, ascending from the altar of the world. Above the flame the smoke of praise goes up from ocean rim to rim. Tell no more of enchanted days. Smoke went up from the whole earth, from the vapory oceans, smoke of her praise. The earth was like a swinging, smoking, swaying censer, a ball of incense, an ellipsoidal ball. The rhythm died out at once. The cry of his heart was broken. His lips began to murmur the first verses over and over, then went on stumbling through half verses, stammering and baffled, then stopped. The heart's cry was broken. The veiled, windless hour had passed, and behind the panes of the naked window the morning light was gathering. A bell beat faintly very far away. A bird twittered, two birds, three. The bell and the bird ceased, and the dull white light spread itself east and west, covering the world, covering the rose light in his heart. Fearing to lose all, he raised himself suddenly on his elbow to look for paper and pencil. There was neither on the table, only the soup plate he had eaten the rice from for supper, and the candlestick with its tendrils of tallow and its paper socket, signed by the last flame. He stretched his arm wearily towards the foot of the bed, groping with his hand in the pockets of the coat that hung there. His fingers found a pencil and then a cigarette packet. He lay back and, tearing open the packet, placed the last cigarette on the window ledge and began to write out the stanzas of the Villanelle in small neat letters on the rough cardboard surface. Having written them out, he lay back on the lumpy pillow, murmuring them again. The lumps of knotted flock under his head reminded him of the lumps of knotted horsehair on the sofa of her parlour on which he used to sit, smiling or serious, asking himself why he had come, displeased with her and with himself, confounded by the print of the Sacred Heart above the untenanted sideboard. He saw her approach him in a lull of the talk and beg him to sing one of his curious songs. Then he saw himself sitting at the old piano, striking chords softly from its speckled keys and singing amid the talk which had risen again in the room to her who leaned beside the mantelpiece, a dainty song of the Elizabethans, a sad and sweet lost to part, the victory chant of Agincourt, the happy air of Greensleeves. While he sang and she listened or feigned to listen, his heart was at rest, but when the quaint old songs had ended and he heard again the voices in the room, he remembered his own sarcasm, the house where young men are called by their Christian names a little too soon. At certain instants her eyes seemed about to trust him, but he had waited in vain. She passed now, dancing lightly across his memory, as she had been that night at the carnival ball, her white dress a little lifted, a white spray nodding in her hair. She danced lightly in the round. She was dancing towards him, and as she came her eyes were a little averted, and a faint glow was on her cheek. At the pause in the chain of hands, her hand had lain in his an instant, a soft merchandise. "You are a great stranger now." "Yes, I was born to be a monk." "I am afraid you are a heretic." "Are you much afraid?" For answer she had danced away from him along the chain of hands, dancing lightly and discreetly, giving herself to none. The white spray nodded to her dancing, and when she was in shadow the glow was deeper on her cheek. A monk! His own image started forth, a profaner of the cloister, a heretic Franciscan, willing and willing not to serve, spinning like Gherardino da Borgo San Domino a lithe web of sophistry and whispering in her ear. No, it was not his image. It was like the image of the young priest in whose company he had seen her last, looking at him out of dove's eyes, toying with the pages of her Irish phrase book. "Yes, yes, the ladies are coming round to us. I can see it every day. The ladies are with us. The best helpers the language has." "And the church, Father Moran?" "The church, too. Coming round, too. The work is going ahead there, too. Don't fret about the church." "Bah." He had done well to leave the room in disdain. He had done well not to salute her on the steps of the library. He had done well to leave her to flirt with her priest, to toy with a church which was a scullery maid of Christendom. Rude, brutal anger routed the last lingering instant of ecstasy from his soul. It broke up violently her fair image and flung the fragments on all sides. On all sides, distorted reflections of her image started from his memory. The flower girl in the ragged dress with damp coarse hair and a hoyden's face, who had called herself his own girl and begged his handsel. The kitchen girl in the next house, who sang over the clatter of her plates with the drawl of a country singer, the first bars of By Killarney's Lakes and Fells. A girl who had laughed gaily to see him stumble when the iron grating in the footpath near Cork Hill had caught the broken sole of his shoe. A girl he had glanced at, attracted by her small white mouth as she passed out of Jacob's biscuit factory, who had cried to him over her shoulder, "Do you like what you've seen of me, straight hair and curly eyebrows?" And yet he felt that, however he might revile and mock her image, his anger was also a form of homage. He had left the classroom in disdain and was not, that was not wholly sincere. Feeling that perhaps the secret of her race lay behind those dark eyes upon which her long lashes flung a quick shadow. He had told himself bitterly as he walked through the streets that she was a figure of the womanhood of her country, a bat-like soul waking to the consciousness of itself in darkness and secrecy and loneliness, tarrying a while, loveless and sinless, with her mild lover, and leaving him to whisper of innocent transgressions in the latticed ear of a priest. His anger against her found vent in coarse railing at her paramour, whose name and voice and features offended his baffled pride. A priested peasant with a brother a policeman in Dublin and a brother a potboy in Moycullen. To him she would unveil her soul's shy nakedness, to one who was but schooled in the discharging of a formal rite, rather than to him, a priest of eternal imagination, transmuting the daily bread of experience into the radiant body of ever-living life. The radiant image of the Eucharist united again in an instant his bitter and despairing thoughts, their cries arising unbroken in a hymn of thanksgiving. Our broken cries and mournful lays rise in one Eucharistic hymn. Are you not weary of ardent ways? While sacrificing hands upraise, the chalice flowing to the brim, tell no more of enchanted days. He spoke the verses aloud from the first lines, till the music and rhythm suffused his mind, turning it to quiet indulgence, then copied them painfully to feel them the better by seeing them, then lay back on his bolster. The full morning light had come. No sound was to be heard, but he knew that all around him life was about to awaken in common noises, hoarse voices, sleepy prayers. Shrinking from that life, he turned towards the wall, making a cowl of the blanket and staring at the great overblown scarlet flowers of the tattered wallpaper. He tried to warm his perishing joy in their scarlet glow, imagining a roseway from where he lay upwards to heaven, all strewn with scarlet flowers. Weary, weary, he too was weary of ardent ways. A gradual warmth, a languorous weariness passed over him, descending along his spine from his closely cowled head. He felt it descend, and seeing himself as he lay, smiled. Soon he would sleep. He had written verses for her again after 10 years. 10 years before she had worn her shawl cowl-wise about her head, sending sprays of her warm breath into the night air, tapping her foot upon the glassy road. It was the last tram. The lank brown horses knew it and shook their bells to the clear night in admonition. The conductor talked with the driver, both nodding often in the green light of the lamp. They stood on the steps of the tram, he on the upper, she on the lower. She came up to his step many times between their phrases and went down again, and once or twice remained beside him, forgetting to go down, and then went down. Let be, let be. 10 years from that wisdom of children to his folly. If he sent her the verses, they would be read out at breakfast amid the tapping of eggshells. Folly indeed. The brothers would laugh and try to wrest the page from each other with their strong, hard fingers. The suave priest, her uncle, seated in his armchair, would hold the page at arm's length, reading it, smiling and approve of the literary form. No, no, that was folly. If he sent her the verses, she would not show them to others. No, no, she could not. He began to feel that he had wronged her. A sense of her innocence moved him almost to pity her, an innocence he had never understood till he had come to the knowledge of it through sin, an innocence which she too had not understood while she was innocent, or before the strange humiliation of her nature had first come upon her. Then first her soul had begun to live as his soul had when he had first sinned, and a tender compassion filled his heart as he remembered her frail pallor, and her eyes, humbled and saddened by the dark shame of womanhood. While his soul had passed from ecstasy to languor, where had she been? Might it be in the mysterious ways of spiritual life that her soul at those same moments had been conscious of his homage? It might be. A glow of desire kindled again his soul, and fired and fulfilled all his body. Conscious of his desire, she was walking, waking from odorous sleep, the temptress of his villanelle. Her eyes dark and with a look of languor were opening to his eyes. Her nakedness yielded to him. radiant, warm, odorous and lavish-limbed, enfolded him like a shining cloud, enfolded him like water with a liquid life, and like a cloud of vapour or like waters circumfluent in space the liquid letters of speech, symbols of the element of mystery, flowed forth over his brain. Are you not weary of ardent ways, lure of the fallen seraphim? Tell no more of enchanted days. Your eyes have set man's heart ablaze, and you have had your will of him. Are you not weary of ardent ways? Above the flame the smoke of praise goes up from ocean rim to rim. Tell no more of enchanted days. Our broken cries and mournful lays rise in one eucharistic hymn. Are you not weary of ardent ways? While sacrificing hands upraise, the chalice flowing to the brim, tell no more of enchanted days. And still you hold our longing gaze, with languorous look and lavish limb. Are you not weary of ardent ways? Tell no more of enchanted days. What birds were they? He stood on the steps of the library to look at them, leaning wearily on his ash plant. They flew round and round the jutting shoulder of a house in Molesworth Street. The air of the late March evening made clear their flight, their dark, darting, quivering bodies flying clearly against the sky as against a limp-hung cloth of smoky, tenuous blue. He watched their flight, bird after bird, a dark flash, a swerve, a flash again, a dart again, a side, a curve, a flutter of wings. He tried to count them before all their darting, quivering bodies passed. 6, 10, 11, and wondered were they odd or even in number. 12, 13, for two came wheeling down from the upper sky. They were flying high and low, but ever round and round in straight and curving lines, and ever flying from left to right, circling about a temple of air. He listened to the cries, like the squeak of mice behind the wainscot, a shrill twofold note, but the notes were long and shrill and whirring, unlike the cry of vermin, falling a third or a fourth, and trilled as the flying beaks clove the air. Their cry was shrill and clear and fine, and falling like threads of silken light unwound from whirring spools. The inhuman clamour soothed his ears, in which his mother's sobs and reproaches murmured insistently, and the dark, frail, quivering bodies wheeling and fluttering and swerving round an airy temple of the tenuous sky soothed his eyes, which still saw the image of his mother's face. Why was he gazing upwards from the steps of the porch, hearing their shrill twofold cry, watching their flight? For an augury of good or evil? A phrase of Cornelius Agrippa flew through his mind, and then there flew hither and thither shapeless thoughts from Swedenborg on the correspondence of birds to things of the intellect, and of how the creatures of the air have their knowledge and know their times and seasons, because they, unlike man, are in the order of their life and have not perverted that order by reason. And for ages men had gazed upward as he was gazing at birds in flight. The colonnade above him made him think vaguely of an ancient temple, and the ash plant too, the ash plant on which he leaned wearily of the curved stick of an auger. A sense of fear of the unknown moved in his heart, in the heart of his weariness, a fear of symbols and portents, of the hawk-like man whose name he bore soaring out of his captivity on azure-woven things, wings of Thoth, of Thoth, the god of writers, writing with a reed upon a tablet and bearing on his narrow ibis head the cusped moon. He smiled as he thought of the god's image, for it made him think of a bottle-nosed judge in a wig, putting commas into a document which he held at arm's length, and he knew that he would not have remembered the god's name, but that it was like an Irish oath. It was folly. But it was for this folly that he was about to leave for ever the house of prayer and prudence into which he had been born, and the order of life out of which he had come. They came back with shrill cries over the jutting shoulder of the house, flying darkly against the faded air. What birds were they? He thought that they must be swallows who had come back from the south. Then he was to go away, for they were birds ever going and coming, building ever an unlasting home under the eaves of men's houses, and ever leaving the homes they had built to wander. Bend down your faces, Una and Alil. I gaze upon them as the swallow gazes upon the nest under the eave before he wander the loud waters. A soft, liquid joy, like the noise of many waters, flowed over his memory, and he felt in his heart the soft peace of silent spaces, of fading, tenuous sky above the waters, of oceanic silence, of swallows flying through sea dusk over the flowing waters. A soft, liquid joy flowed through the words where the soft long vowels hurtled noiselessly and fell away, lapping and flowing back and ever shaking the white bells of their waves in mute chime and mute peal and soft, low, swooning cry. And he felt that the augury he had sought in the wheeling, darting birds and in the pale space of sky above him had come forth from his heart like a bird from a turret, quickly and swiftly. Symbol of departure or of loneliness. The verses crooned in the ear of his memory composed slowly before his remembering eyes the scene of the hall on the night of the opening of the National Theatre. He was alone at the side of the balcony, looking out of jaded eyes at the culture of Dublin in the stalls, and at the tawdry scene clothes and human dolls framed by the garish lamps of the stage. A burly policeman sweated behind him and seemed at every moment about to act. The catcalls and hisses and mocking cries ran in rude gusts round the hall from his scattered fellow students. "A libel on Ireland! Made in Germany! Blasphemy! We never sold our faith! No Irish woman ever did it! We want no amateur atheists! We want no budding Buddhists!" A sudden swift hiss fell from the window above him, and he knew that the electric lamps had been switched on in the reader's room. He turned into the pillared hall, now calmly lit, went up the staircase and passed in through the clicking turnstile. Cranley was sitting over near the dictionaries. A thick book opened at the frontispiece lay before him on the wooden rest. He leaned back in his chair, inclining his ear like that of a confessor to the face of the medical student who was reading to him a problem from the chess page of a journal. Stephen sat at his right, and the priest on the other side of the table closed his copy of the tablet with an angry snap and stood up. Cranley gazed after him blandly and vaguely. The medical student went on in a softer voice, "Pawn to Kingsforth." "We'd better go, Dixon," said Stephen in warning. "He has gone to complain." Dixon folded the journal and rose with dignity, saying, "Our men retired in good order." "With guns and cattle," added Stephen, pointing to the title page of Cranley's book, on which was printed Diseases of the Ox. As they passed through a lane of the tables, Stephen said, "Cranley, I want to speak with you." "To you." Cranley did not answer or turn. He laid his book on the counter and passed out, his well-shod feet sounding flatly on the floor. On the staircase he paused, and gazing absently at Dixon, repeated, "Pawn to King's bloody Forth." "Put it that way if you like," Dixon said. He had a quiet, toneless voice and urbane manners, and on a finger of his plump, clean hand he displayed at moments a signet ring. As they crossed the hall, a man of dwarfish stature came towards them. Under the dome of his tiny hat, his unshaven face began to smile with pleasure, and he was heard to murmur. The eyes were melancholy as those of a monkey. "Good evening, Captain," said Cranley, halting. "Good evening, gentlemen," said the stubble-grown monkeyish face. "Warm weather for March," said Cranley. "They have the windows open upstairs." Dixon smiled and turned his ring. The blackish, monkey-puckered face pursed its human mouth with gentle pleasure, and its voice purred. "Delightful measure, delightful weather for March, simply delightful." "There are two nice young ladies upstairs, Captain, tired of waiting," Dixon said. Cranley smiled and said kindly, "The Captain has only one love, Sir Walter Scott. Isn't that so, Captain?"
"What are you reading now, Captain?" Dixon asked.
"The Bride of Lammermoor."
"I love old Scott," the flexible lips said. "I think he writes something lovely. There's no writer can touch Sir Walter Scott."
He moved a thin, shrunken brown hand gently in the air in time to his praise, and his thin, quick eyelids beat often over his sad eyes. Sadder to Stephen's ear was his speech, a genteel accent, low and moist, marred by errors. And listening to it, he wondered, was the story true, and was the thin blood that flowed in his shrunken frame noble and come of an incestuous love? The park trees were heavy with rain, and rain fell still and ever in the lake, lying grey like a shield. A game of swans flew there, and the water and the shore beneath were fouled with their green-white slime. They embraced softly, impelled by the grey rainy light, the wet, silent trees, the shield-like witnessing lake, the swans. They embraced without joy or passion, his arm about his sister's neck. A grey woollen cloak was wrapped athwart her from her shoulder to her waist, and her fair head was bent in willing shame. He had loose red-brown hair and tender, shapely, strong, freckled hands. Face, there was no face seen. The brother's face was bent upon her fair, rain-fragrant hair. The hand, freckled and strong and shapely and caressing, was Davin's hand. He frowned angrily upon his thought and on the shivering, shriveled mannikin who had called it forth. His father's jibes at the Bantry gang leaped out of his memory. He held them at a distance and brooded uneasily on his own thought again. Why were they not Cranley's hands? Had Davin's simplicity and innocence stung him more secretly? He walked on across the hall with Dixon, leaving Cranley to take elaborate leave of the dwarf. Under the colonnade, Temple was standing in the midst of a little group of students. One of them cried, "Dixon, come over till you hear. Temple is in grand form." Temple turned on him with dark gypsy eyes. "You're a hypocrite, O'Keefe," he said. "And Dixon the smiler. By hell, I think that's a good literary expression." He laughed slyly, looking in Stephen's face, repeating, "By hell, I'm delighted with that name, a smiler." A stout student who stood below them on the steps said, "Come back to the mistress, Temple. We want to hear about that."
"He had, faith," Temple said. "And he was a married man, too. And all the priests used to be dining there. By hell, I think they all had a touch."
"We shall call it riding a hack to spare to Hunter," said Dixon.
"Tell us, Temple," O'Keefe said. "How many quarts of porter have you in you?"
All your intellectual soul is in that phrase, O'Keefe," said Temple with open scorn. He moved with shambling gait round the group and spoke to Stephen.
"Did you know that the foresters are the kings of Belgium?" he asked.
Cranley came out through the door of the entrance hall, his hat thrust back on the nape of his neck and picking his teeth with care.
"And here's the wiseacre," said Temple. "Do you know that about the foresters?"
He paused for an answer.
Cranley dislodged a fig seed from his teeth on the point of his rude toothpick and gazed at it intently. "The Forrester family," Temple said, "is descended from Baldwin the First, King of Flanders. He was called the Forrester. Forrester and Forrester are the same name. A descendant of Baldwin, the first Captain Francis Forrester, settled in Ireland and married the daughter of the last chieftain of Clanbrassil. Then there are the Blake Forresters. That's a different branch."
"From Baldhead, King of Flanders," Cranley repeated, rooting again deliberately at his gleaming, uncovered teeth.
"Where'd you pick up all that history?" O'Keefe asked.
"I know all the history of your family, too," Temple said, turning to Stephen. "Do you know what Giraldus Cambrensis says about your family?"
"Is he descended from Baldwin, too?" asked a tall, consumptive student with dark eyes.
"Bald head," Cranley repeated, sucking at the crevice in his teeth.
"Per nobilis et per vestusta familia," Temple said to Stephen.
The stout student who stood below them on the steps farted briefly. Dixon turned towards him, saying in a soft voice, "Did an angel speak?" Cranley turned also and said vehemently, but without anger,
"Goggins, you are the flamingest dirty devil I ever met, do you know?"
"I had on my mind to say that," Goggins answered firmly. "It did no one any harm, did it?"
"We hope," Dixon said suavely, "that it was not of the kind known to science as a Paolo post futurum."
"Didn't I tell you he was a smiler?" said Temple, turning right and left. "Didn't I give him that name?"
"You did. We're not deaf," said the tall consumptive. Cranley still frowned at the stout student below him. Then, with a snort of disgust, he shoved him violently down the steps.
"Get away from here," he said rudely. "Go away, you stinkpot. You are a stinkpot."
Goggins skipped down to the gravel and at once returned to his place with good humour. Temple turned back to Stephen and asked,
"Do you believe in the law of heredity?"
"Are you drunk, or what are you, or what are you trying to say?" asked Cranley, facing round on him with an expression of wonder.
"The most profound sentence ever written," Temple said with enthusiasm, "is the sentence at the end of the zoology. Reproduction is the beginning of death."
He touched Stephen timidly at the elbow and said eagerly,
"Do you feel how profound that is because you are a poet?"
Cranley pointed his long forefinger.
"Look at him," he said with scorn to the others. "Look at Ireland's hope."
They laughed at his words and gesture. Temple turned on him bravely, saying, "Cranley, you're always sneering at me, I can see that, but I am as good as you any day. Do you know what I think about you now as compared with myself?"
"My dear man," said Cranley urbanely, "you are incapable, do you know, absolutely incapable of thinking."
"But do you know," Temple went on, "what I think of you and of myself compared together?"
"Get on with it, Temple," the stout student cried from the steps. "Get it out in bits."
Temple turned right and left, making sudden feeble gestures as he spoke.
"I'm a ballocks," he said, shaking his head in despair. "I am, and I know I am, and I admit that I am."
Dixon patted him lightly on the shoulder and said mildly, "And it does you every credit, Temple."
"But he," Temple said, pointing to Cranley, "he is a ballocks too, like me, only he doesn't know it, and that's the only difference I see."
A burst of laughter covered his words, but he turned again to Stephen and said with a sudden eagerness, "That word is a most interesting word. That's the only English jewel number. Did you know that?"
"Is it?" Stephen said vaguely.
He was watching Cranley's firm-featured, suffering face, lit up now by a smile of false patience. The gross name had passed over it like foul water poured over an old stone image. Patient of injuries, and, as he watched him, he saw him raise his hat in salute and uncover the black hair that stood up stiffly from his forehead like an iron crown. She passed out from the porch of the library and bowed across Stephen in reply to Cranley's greeting.
He also? Was there not a slight flush on Cranley's cheek? Or had it come forth at Temple's words?
The light had waned, he could not see. Did that explain his friend's listless silence, his harsh comments, the sudden intrusions of rude speech with which he had chattered so often Stephen's ardent, wayward confessions? Stephen had forgiven freely, for he had found this rudeness also in himself towards himself, and he remembered an evening when he had dismounted from a borrowed, creaking bicycle to pray to God in a wood near Malahide. He had lifted up his arms and spoken in ecstasy to the sombre nave of the trees, knowing that he stood on holy ground in a holy hour. And when two constabulary men had come into sight round a bend in the gloomy road, he had broken off his prayer to whistle loudly an air from the last pantomime. He began to beat the frayed end of his ash plant against the base of a pillar. Had Cranley not heard him? Yet he could wait. The talk about him ceased for a moment, and a soft hiss fell again from a window above. But no other sound was in the air, and the swallows, whose flight he had followed with idle eyes, were sleeping.
she had passed through the dusk, and therefore the air was silent save for one soft hiss that fell, and therefore the tongues about him had ceased their babble. Darkness was falling. Darkness falls from the air. A trembling joy, lambent as a faint light, played like a fairy host around him. But why? Her passage through the darkening air, or the verse with its black vowels and its opening sound, rich and lute-like? He walked away slowly towards the deeper shadows at the end of the colonnade, beating the stone softly with his stick to hide his reverie from the students whom he had left, and allowed his mind to summon back to itself the age of Dowland and Bird and Nash. Eyes opening from the darkness of desire, eyes that dimmed the breaking east. What was their languid grace but the softness of chambering? And what was their shimmer but the shimmer of the scum that mantled the cesspool of the court of a slobbering Stuart? And he tasted in the language of memory ambered wines, dying fallings of sweet airs, the proud pavan, and saw with the eyes of memory kind gentlewomen in convent garden wooing from their balconies with sucking mouths, and the pox-fouled wenches of the taverns, and young wives that, gaily yielding to their ravishers, clipped and clipped again. The images he had summoned gave him no pleasure. They were secret and inflaming, but her image was not entangled by them. That was not the way to think of her. It was not even the way in which he thought of her. Could his mind then not trust itself? Old phrases, sweet only with a disinterested sweetness like the fig seeds Cranley rooted out of his gleaming teeth. It was not thought, nor vision, though he knew vaguely that her figure was passing homeward through the city. Vaguely first, and then more sharply he smelt her body. A conscious unrest seethed in his blood. Yes, it was her body he smelt. A wild and languid smell, the tepid limbs over which his music had flowed desirously, and the secret soft linen upon which her flesh distilled odour and the dew. A louse crawled over the nape of his neck, and putting his thumb and forefinger deftly between his loose collar, he caught it. He rolled its body, tender yet brittle as a grain of rice, between thumb and finger for an instant before he let it fall from him, and wondered would it live or die. There came to his mind a curious phrase from Cornelius a Lapide, which said that the lice born of human sweat were not created by God with other animals on the sixth day. But the tickling of the skin of his neck made his mind raw and red. The life of his body, ill-clad, ill-fed, louse-eaten, made him close his eyelids in a sudden spasm of despair, and in the darkness he saw the brittle, bright bodies of lice falling from the air and turning often as they fell. Yes, and it was not darkness that fell from the air. It was brightness. Brightness falls from the air. He had not even remembered rightly Nash's line. All the images it had awakened were false. His mind bred vermin. His thoughts were lice born of the sweat of sloth. He came back quickly along the colonnade towards the group of students. Well then, let her go and be damned to her. She could love some clean athlete who washed himself every morning to the waist and had black hair on his chest. Let her! Cranley had taken another dried fig from the supply in his pocket, and was eating it slowly and noisily. Temple sat on the pediment of a pillar, leaning back, his cap pulled down on his sleepy eyes. A squat young man came out of the porch, a leather portfolio tucked under his armpit. He marched towards the group, striking the flags with the heels of his boots and with the ferrule of his heavy umbrella. Then, raising the umbrella in salute, he said to all, "Good evening, sirs." He struck the flags again and tittered, while his head trembled with a slight nervous movement. The tall consumptive student and Dixon and O'Keefe were speaking in Irish and did not answer him. Then turning to Cranley, he said, "Good evening particularly to you." He moved the umbrella in indication and tittered again. Cranley, who was still chewing the fig, answered with loud movements of his jaws, "Good? Yes, it is a good evening." The squat student looked at him seriously and shook his umbrella gently and reprovingly. "I could see," he said, "that you were about to make obvious remarks." Cranley answered, holding out what remained of the half-chewed fig and jerking it towards the squat student's mouth in sign that he should eat. The squat student did not eat, but, indulging his special humour, said gravely, still tittering and prodding his phrase with his umbrella, "Do you intend that?" He broke off, pointed bluntly to the munched pulp of the fig and said loudly, "I allude to that?" Cranley said as before. "Do you intend that now?" the squat student said. "As ipso facto, or let us say, as so to speak." Dixon turned aside from his group, saying, "Goggins was waiting for you, Glynn. He has gone round to the Adelphi to look for you and Moynihan." "What have you there?" he asked, tapping the portfolio under Glynn's arms. "Examination papers," Glynn answered. "I give them monthly examinations to see that they are profiting by my tuition." He also tapped the portfolio and coughed gently and smiled. "Tuition," said Cranley rudely. "I suppose you mean the barefooted children that are taught by a bloody ape like you, God help them." He bit off the rest of the fig and flung away the butt. "I suffer little children to come unto me," Glynn said amiably. "A bloody ape," Cranley repeated with emphasis, "and a blasphemous bloody ape." Temple stood up and, pushing past Cranley, addressed Glynn. "That phrase you said now," he said, "is from the New Testament about suffer the children to come to me." "Go to sleep again, Temple," said O'Keefe. "Very well, then," Temple continued, still addressing Glynn. "And if Jesus suffered the children to come, why does the church send them all to hell if they die unbaptized? Why is that?" "Were you baptized yourself, Temple?" the consumptive student asked. "But why are they sent to hell if Jesus said they were all to come?" Temple said, his eyes searching in Glynn's eye. Glynn coughed and said gently, holding back with difficulty the nervous titter in his voice, and moving his umbrella at every word, "And, as you remark, if it is thus, I ask emphatically, whence comes the thusness?" "Because the church is cruel like all old sinners," Temple said.
"Are you quite orthodox in that point, Temple?" Dixon said suavely.
"St. Augustine says that about unbaptized children going to hell," Temple answered, "because he was a cruel old sinner too."
"I bow to you," Dixon said, "but I had the impression that limbo existed for such cases.
"Don't argue with him, Dixon," Cranley said brutally. "Don't talk to him or look at him. Let him lead him home with a shucking the way you lead a bleating goat."
"Limbo," Temple cried, "that's a fine invention too. Like hell."
"But with the unpleasantness left out," Dixon said. He turned, smiling to the others, and said, "I think I am voicing the opinions of all present in saying so much."
"You are," Glynn said in a firm tone. "On that point, Ireland is united."
He struck the ferrule of his umbrella on the stone floor of the colonnade.
"Hell," Temple said. "I can respect that invention of the grey spouse of Satan. Hell is Roman, like the walls of the Romans, strong and ugly. But what is limbo?"
"Put him back into the perambulator, Cranley," O'Keefe called out. Cranley made a swift step towards Temple, halted, stamping his foot, crying as if to a fowl, "Hoosh!" Temple moved away nimbly.
"Do you know what limbo is?" he cried. "Do you know what we call a notion like that in Roscommon?"
"Hoosh, blast ye!" Cranley cried, clapping his hands.
"Neither my arse nor my elbow," Temple cried out scornfully, "and that's what I call limbo."
"Give us that stick here," Cranley said. He snatched the ash plant roughly from Stephen's hand and sprang down the steps, but Temple, hearing him move in pursuit, fled through the dusk like a wild creature, nimble and fleet-footed.
Cranley's heavy boots were heard loudly charging across the quadrangle, and then returning heavily foiled and spurning the gravel at each step. His step was angry, and with an angry, abrupt gesture he thrust the stick back into Stephen's hand. Stephen felt that his anger had another cause, but, feigning patience, touched his arm slightly and said quietly, "Cranley, I told you I wanted to speak with you. Come away." Cranley looked at him for a few moments and asked, "Now?" "Yes, now," Stephen said. "We can't speak here. Come away." They crossed the quadrangle together without speaking. The bird call from Siegfried whistled softly, followed them from the steps of the porch. Cranley turned, and Dixon, who had whistled, called out, "Where are you fellows off to? What about that game, Cranley?" They parleyed in shouts across the still air about a game of billiards to be played in the Adelphi Hotel. Stephen walked on alone and out into the quiet of Kildare Street. Opposite Maple's Hotel, he stood to wait, patient again. The name of the hotel, a colourless, polished wood, and its colourless quiet front stung him like a glance of polite disdain. He stared angrily back at the softly lit drawing-room at the hotel, in which he imagined the sleek lives of the patricians of Ireland housed in calm. They thought of army commissions and land agents. Peasants greeted them along the roads in the country. They knew the names of certain French dishes and gave orders to Jarvies in high-pitched provincial voices which pierced through their skin-tight accents. How could he hit their conscience, or how cast his shadow over the imaginations of their daughters, before their squires begat upon them, that they might breed a race less ignoble than their own? And under the deepened dusk he felt the thoughts and desires of the race to which he belonged flitting like bats, across the dark country lanes, under trees by the edges of streams, and near the pool-matted bogs. Pool-mottled bogs. A woman had waited in the doorway as Davin had passed by that night, and offering him a cup of milk had all but wooed him to her bed, for Davin had the mild eyes of one who could be secret. But him no woman's eyes had wooed. His arm was taken in a strong grip, and Cranley's voice said, "Let us eke go." They walked southward in silence. Then Cranley said, "That blithering idiot Temple, I swear to Moses, do you know that I'll be the death of that fellow one time?" But his voice was no longer angry, and Stephen wondered, was he thinking of her greeting to him under the porch? They turned to the left and walked on as before. When they had gone on for some time, Stephen said, "Cranley, I had an unpleasant quarrel this evening." "With your people?" Cranley asked. "With my mother." "About religion?" "Yes," Stephen answered. After a pause, Cranley asked, "What age is your mother?" "Not old," Stephen said. "She wishes me to make my Easter duty." "And will you?" "I will not," Stephen said. "Why not?" Cranley asked. "I will not serve," answered Stephen. "That remark was made before," Cranley said calmly. "It is made behind now," said Stephen hotly. Cranley pressed Stephen's arm, saying, "Go easy, my dear man. You are an excitable bloody man, do you know?" He laughed nervously as he spoke, and, looking up into Stephen's face with moved and friendly eyes, said, "Do you know that you are an excitable man?" "I dare say I am," said Stephen, laughing also. Their minds, lately estranged, seemed suddenly to have been drawn closer one to the other. "Do you believe in the Eucharist?" Cranley asked. "I do not," Stephen said. "Do you disbelieve, then?" "I neither believe in it nor disbelieve in it," Stephen answered. "Many persons have doubts, even religious persons, yet they overcome them or put them aside," Cranley said. "Are your doubts on that point too strong?"
"I do not wish to overcome them," Stephen answered.
Cranley, embarrassed for a moment, took another fig from his pocket and was about to eat it when Stephen said, "Don't, please. You cannot discuss this question with your mouth full of chewed fig." Cranley examined the fig by the light of a lamp under which he halted. Then he smelt it with both nostrils, bit a tiny piece, spat it out, and withdrew the fig rudely into the gutter. Addressing it as it lay, he said, "Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire." Taking Stephen's arm, he went on again and said, "Do you not fear that those words may be spoken to you on the day of judgment?" "What is offered me on the other hand?" Stephen asked. "An eternity of bliss in the company of the Dean of Studies?"
Remember, Cranley said, that he would be glorified.
Ah, Stephen said somewhat bitterly, bright, agile, impassible, and above all subtle.
"Is a curious thing, you know," Cranley said dispassionately, "how your mind is supersaturated with the religion in which you say you disbelieve. Did you believe in it when you were in school? I bet you did."
"I did," Stephen answered.
"And were you happier then?" Cranley asked softly. "Happier than you are now, for instance?"
"Often happy," Stephen said, "and often unhappy. I was someone else then."
"How someone else? What do you mean by that statement?"
"I mean," said Stephen, "that I was not myself as I am now, as I had to become."
"Not as you are now, not as you had to become," Cranley repeated. "Let me ask you a question. Do you love your mother?"
Stephen shook his head slowly.
"I don't know what your words mean," he said simply.
"Have you never loved anyone?" Cranley asked.
"Do you mean women?"
"I'm not speaking of that," Cranley said in a colder tone. "I ask you if you have ever felt love towards anyone or anything." Stephen walked on beside his friend, staring gloomily at the footpath. "I tried to love God," he said at length. "It seems now I failed. It is very difficult. I tried to unite my will with the will of God instant by instant. In that I did not always fail. I could perhaps do that still."
Cranley cut him short by asking, "Has your mother had a happy life?"
"How do I know?" Stephen said.
"How many children had she?"
9 or 10, Stephen answered. "Some died."
"Was your father..."
Cranley interrupted himself for an instant and then said,
"I don't want to pry into your family affairs, but was your father what is called well-to-do, I mean, when you were growing up?"
"Yes," Stephen said.
"What was he?"
Cranley asked after a pause.
Stephen began to enumerate glibly his father's attributes. "A medical student, an oarsman, a tenor, an amateur actor, a shouting politician, a small landlord, a small investor, a drinker, a good fellow, a storyteller, somebody's secretary, something in a distillery, a tax gatherer, a bankrupt, and at present a praiser of his own past."
Cranley laughed, tightened his grip on Stephen's arm, and said,
"The distillery is damn good."
"Is there anything else you want to know?" Stephen asked.
"Are you in good circumstances at present?"
"Do I look it?" Stephen asked bluntly.
"So then," Cranley went on musingly, "you are born in the lap of luxury."
He used the phrase broadly and loudly, as he often used technical expressions, as if he wished his hearer to understand that they were used by him without conviction.
"Your mother must have gone through a good deal of suffering," he said then. "Would you not try to save her from suffering more, even if... or would you?"
"If I could," Stephen said, "that would cost me very little."
"Then do so," Cranley said. "Do as she wishes you to do. What is it for you? You disbelieve in it. It is a form, nothing else. And you will set her mind at rest."
He ceased, and as Stephen did not reply, remained silent. Then, as if giving utterance to the process of his own thought, he said,
"Whatever else is untrue in this stinking dunghill of a world, a mother's love is not. Your mother brings you into the world, carries you first in her body. What do we know about what she feels? But whatever she feels, it at least must be real. It must be. What are our ideas or ambitions? Play, ideas. Why, that bloody bleating goat Temple has ideas. McCann has ideas too. Every jackass going along the road thinks he has ideas."
Stephen, who had been listening to the unspoken speech behind the words, said with assumed carelessness,
"Pascal, if I remember rightly, would not suffer his mother to kiss him as he feared the contact of her sex."
"Pascal was a pig," said Cranley.
"Aloysius Gonzaga, I think, was of the same mind," Stephen said.
"And he was another pig then," said Cranley.
"The church calls him a saint," Stephen objected. "I don't care a flaming damn what anyone calls him," Cranley said rudely and flatly. "I call him a pig."
Stephen, preparing the words neatly in his mind, continued, "Jesus, too, seems to have treated his mother with scant courtesy in public. But Suarez, a Jesuit theologian and Spanish gentleman, has apologized for him."
"Does the idea ever occur to you," Cranley asked, "that Jesus was not what he pretended to be?"
"The first person to whom that idea occurred," Stephen answered, "was Jesus himself."
"I mean," Cranley said, hardening in his speech, "did the idea ever occur to you that he was himself a conscious hypocrite, what he called the Jews of his time, a whited sepulchre, or to put it more plainly, that he was a blackguard.
That idea never occurred to me, Stephen answered, but I am curious to know, are you trying to make a convert of me or a pervert of yourself? He turned towards his friend's face and saw there a raw smile which some force of will strove to make finely significant. Cranley asked suddenly in a plain, sensible tone, "Tell me the truth. Were you at all shocked by what I said?"
"Somewhat," Stephen said.
"And why were you shocked?" Cranley pressed on in the same tone. "If you feel sure that our religion is false and that Jesus was not the Son of God..."
"I am not at all sure of it," Stephen said. "He is more like a son of God than a son of Mary."
"And is that why you will not communicate?" Cranley said. "Because you are not sure of that too, because you feel that the host too may be the body and blood of the Son of God and not a wafer of bread, and because you fear that it may be?"
"Yes," Stephen said quietly. "I feel that, and I also fear it."
"I see," Cranley said. Stephen, struck by his tone of closure, reopened the discussion at once by saying, "I fear many things. Dogs, horses, firemen, firearms, the sea, thunderstorms, machinery, the country roads at night."
"But why do you fear a bit of bread?"
"I imagine," Stephen said, "that there is a malevolent reality behind those things I say I fear." "Do you fear then," Cranley asked, "that the God of the Roman Catholics would strike you dead and damn you if you made a sacrilegious communion?"
"The God of the Roman Catholics could do that now," Stephen said.
"I fear more than that the chemical action which would be set up in my soul by a false homage to a symbol behind which are massed 20 centuries of authority and veneration."
"Would you," Cranley asked, "in extreme danger, commit that particular sacrilege? For instance, if you lived in the penal days..."
"I cannot answer for the past," Stephen replied. "Possibly not."
"Then," said Cranley, "do you not intend to become a Protestant?"
"I said that I had lost the faith," Stephen answered. "Not that I had lost self-respect. What kind of liberation would that be, to forsake an absurdity which is logical and coherent, and to embrace one which is illogical and incoherent?"
They had walked on towards the township of Pembroke, and now, as they went on slowly along the avenues, the trees and the scattered lights in the villas soothed their minds. The air of wealth and repose diffused about them seemed to comfort their neediness. Behind a hedge of laurel a light glimmered in the window of a kitchen, and the voice of a servant was heard singing as she sharpened knives. She sang in soft, short, broken bars, "Rosie O'Grady."
Cranley stopped to listen, saying, "Mulier cantat." The soft beauty of the Latin word touched with an enchanting touch the dark of the evening, with a touch fainter and more persuading than the touch of music or of a woman's hand. The strife of their minds was quelled. The figure of woman as she appears in the liturgy of the church passed silently through the darkness, a white-robed figure, small and slender as a boy, and with a falling girdle. Her voice, frail and high as a boy's, was heard intoning from a distant choir the first words of a woman which pierced the gloom and clamour of the first chanting of the Passion. "Et tu cum Jesu Gallicu eras." And their hearts were touched and turned to her voice, shining like a young star.
Shining like a young star, shining clearer as the voice intoned the proparoxyton, and more faintly as the cadence died. The singing ceased. They went on together, Cranley repeating in strongly stressed rhythm at the end of the refrain. Cranley repeating in strongly stressed rhythm the end of the refrain. "And when we are married, oh, how happy we'll be, for I love sweet Rosie O'Grady, and Rosie O'Grady loves me."
"That's real poetry for you," he said. "That's real love."
He glanced sideways at Stephen with a strange smile and said,
"Do you consider that poetry, or do you know what the words mean?"
"I want to see Rosie first," said Stephen.
"She's easy to find," Cranley said.
His hat had come down on his forehead. He shoved it back, and in the shadow of the trees Stephen saw his pale face, framed by the dark, and his large dark eyes.
"Yes."
His face was handsome, and his body was strong and hard. He had spoken of a mother's love.
He felt then the sufferings of women, the weaknesses of their bodies and souls, and would shield them with a strong and resolute arm, and bow his mind to them. "Away, then, it is time to go." A voice spoke softly to Stephen's lonely heart, bidding him go and telling him that his friendship was coming to an end. Yes, he would go. He could not strive against another. He knew his part. "Probably I shall go away," he said. "Where?" Crenley asked. "Where I can," Stephen said. "Yes," Crenley said. "It might be difficult for you to live here now, but is it that that makes you go?" "I have to go," Stephen answered.
"Because," Crenley continued, "you need not look upon yourself as driven away if you do not wish to go, or as a heretic or an outlaw. There are many good believers who think as you do. Would that surprise you? The church is not the stone building, nor even the clergy and their dogmas. It is the whole mass of those born into it. I don't know what you wish to do in life. Is it what you told me the night we were standing outside Harcourt Street Station?"
"Yes," Stephen said, smiling in spite of himself, at Cranley's way of remembering thoughts in connection with places. "The night she spent half an hour wrangling with Doherty about the shortest way from Sally Gap to Larras."
"Pothead," Cranley said with calm contempt. "What does he know about the way from Sally Gap to Larras? Or what does he know about anything for that matter? And the big slobbering washing pot head of him?"
He broke out into a loud, long laugh.
"Well," Stephen said, "do you remember the rest?"
"What you said, is it?" Cranley asked.
"Yes, I remember it. To discover the mode of life or of art whereby your spirit could express itself in unfettered freedom."
Stephen raised his hat in acknowledgement.
"Freedom," Cranley repeated. "But you are not free enough yet to commit a sacrilege. Tell me, would you rob?"
"I would beg first," Stephen said.
"And if you got nothing, would you rob?"
"You wish me to say," Stephen answered, "that the rights of property are provisional, and that, in certain circumstances, it is not unlawful to rob. Everyone would act in that belief. So I will not make you that answer. Apply to the Jesuit theologian, Juan Mariana de Talavera, who will also explain to you in what circumstances you may lawfully kill your king, and whether you had better hand him his poison in a goblet, or smear it for him upon his robe or his saddle-brow. Ask me, rather, would I suffer others to rob me, or if they did, would I call down upon them what I believe is called the chastisement of the secular arm?"
"And would you?"
"I think," Stephen said, "it would pain me as much to do so as to be robbed."
"I see," Cranley said.
He produced his match and began to clean the crevice between two teeth. Then he said carelessly,
"Tell me, for example, would you deflower a virgin?"
"Excuse me," Stephen said politely. "Is that not the ambition of most young gentlemen?"
"What then is your point of view?"
Cranley asked. His last phrase, sour-smelling as the smoke of charcoal, and disheartening, excited Stephen's brain, over which its fumes seemed to brood.
"Look here, Cranley," he said. "You have asked me what I would do and what I would not do. I will tell you what I will do and what I will not do. I will not serve that in which I no longer believe, whether it call itself my home, my fatherland, or my church. And I will try to express myself in some mode of life or art as freely as I can and as wholly as I can, using for my defence the only arms I allow myself to use, silence, exile, and cunning."
Cranley seized his arm and steered him round so as to head back towards Leeson Park. He laughed almost slyly and pressed Stephen's arm with an elder's affection.
"Cunning indeed," he said. "Is it you, you poor poet, you?"
"And you made me confess to you," Stephen said, thrilled by his touch. "As I have confessed to you so many other things, have I not?"
"Yes, my child," Cranley said, still gaily.
You made me confess the fears that I have. But I will tell you also what I do not fear. I do not fear to be alone, or to be spurned for another, or to leave whatever I have to leave. And I am not afraid to make a mistake, even a great mistake, a lifelong mistake, and perhaps as long as eternity, too."
Cranley, now grave again, slowed his pace and said, "Alone, quite alone. You have no fear of that. And you know what that word means? Not only to be separate from all others, but to have not even one friend."
"I will take the risk," said Stephen.
"And not to have any one person," Cranley said, "who would be more than a friend, more even than the noblest and truest friend the man ever had."
His words seemed to have struck some deep chord in his own nature. Had he spoken of himself as he was or wished to be? Stephen watched his face for some moments in silence. A cold sadness was there. He had spoken of himself, of his own loneliness, which he feared.
"Of whom are you speaking?" Stephen asked at length.
Cranley did not answer. March 20.
Long talk with Cranley on the subject of my revolt. He had his grand manner on. I, supple and suave. Attacked me on the score of love for one's mother. Tried to imagine his mother, cannot. Told me once in a moment of thoughtlessness his father was 61 when he was born. Can see him. Strong farmer type. Pepper and salt suit. Square feet. Unkempt grizzle beard. Probably attends coursing matches. Pays his dues regularly but not plentifully to Father Dwyer of Larras. Sometimes talks to girls after nightfall.
But his mother?
Very young or very old? Hardly the first. If so, Cranley would not have spoken as he did.
Old then, probably, and neglected.
Hence Cranley's despair of soul, the child of exhausted loins.
21 March, morning.
Taught this in bed last night, but was too lazy and free to add it. Free, yes. The exhausted loins are those of Elizabeth and Zachary. Then he is the precursor. Item, he eats chiefly belly bacon and dried figs. Read locusts and wild honey. Also, when thinking of him, saw always a stern severed head or a death mask as if outlined on a grey curtain or a veronica. Decollation, they call it in the fold. Puzzled for the moment by St. John at the Latin Gate. What do I see? A decollated precursor trying to pick the lock.
21 March, night.
Free, soul free and fancy free. Let the dead bury the dead. Aye, and let the dead marry the dead.
22 March.
In company with Lynch followed a sizeable hospital nurse. Lynch's idea. Dislike it. Two lean hungry greyhounds walking after a heifer.
23 March.
I've not seen her since that night. Unwell? Sits at the fire perhaps with Mamma's shawl on her shoulders. But not peevish. A nice bowl of gruel, won't you now?
24 March.
Began with a discussion with my mother. Subject BVM. Handicapped by my sex and youth. To escape, held up relations between Jesus and Papa against those between Mary and her son. Said religion was not a lying in hospital. Mother indulgent. Said I have a queer mind and have read too much. Not true. Have read little and understood less. Then she said I would come back to faith because I had a restless mind. This means to leave church by back door of sin and re-enter through the skylight of repentance. Cannot repent. Told her so and asked for sixpence. Got threepence. Then went to college. Other wrangle with little roundhead rogue's eye Gezi. This time about Bruno the Nolan. Began in Italian and ended in pidgin English. He said Bruno was a terrible heretic. I said he was terribly burned. He agreed to this with some sorrow. Then gave me a recipe for what he calls risotto alla bergamasca. When he pronounces a soft O, he protrudes his full carnal lips as if he kissed the vowel. Has he? And could he repent? Yes, he could, and cry two round rogues, tears one from each eye. Crossing Stevens, that is, my green, remembered that his countrymen and not mine had invented what Cranley the other night calls our religion. A quartet of them, soldiers in the 97th Infantry Regiment, sat at the foot of the cross and tossed up dice for the overcoat of the crucified. Went to library. Tried to read 3 reviews. Useless. She's not out yet. Am I alarmed? About what? That she will never be out again. Blake wrote, I wonder if William Bond will die, for assuredly he is very ill. Alas, poor William. I was once at a diorama in Rotunda. At the end were pictures of big knobs, among them William Ewart Gladstone, just then dead. Orchestra played, Oh, Willie, we have missed you. A race of clodhoppers.
25 March, morning.
A troubled night of dreams. Want to get them off my chest. A long curving gallery. From the floor ascend pillars of dark vapours. It is peopled by the images of fabulous kings, set in stone. Their hands are folded upon their knees in token of weariness, and their eyes are darkened, for the errors of men go up before them for ever as dark vapours. Strange figures advance from a cave. They are not as tall as men. One does not seem to stand quite apart from another. Their faces are phosphorescent with darker streaks. They peer at me, and their eyes seem to ask me something. They do not speak. 30 March. This evening, Cranley was in the porch of the library, proposing a problem to Dixon and her brother. A mother let her child fall into the Nile, still harping on the mother. A crocodile seized the child. Mother asked it back. Crocodile said all right if she told him what he was going to do with the child, eat it or not eat it. This mentality, Lepidus would say, is indeed bred out of your mud by the operation of your son. And mine too. Is it not too? Then into Nile mud with it. 1st April. 1 April. Disapprove of this last phrase. 2 April. Saw her drinking tea and eating cakes in Johnson, Mooney and O'Brien's. Rather, Linkside Lynch saw her as we passed. He tells me Cranley was invited there by brother. Did he bring his crocodile? Is he the shining light now? Well, I discovered him, I protest I did, shining quietly behind a bushel of Wicklow bran. 3 April. Met Davin at the cigar shop opposite Findlater's church. He was in a black sweater and had a hurley stick. Asked me was it true I was going away and why. Told him the shortest way to Tara was via Holyhead. Just then my father came up. Introduction. Father polite and observant. Asked Davin if he might offer him some refreshment. Davin could not, was going to a meeting. When we came away, Father told me he had a good, honest eye. Asked me why I did not join a rowing club. I pretended to think it over. Told me then how he broke Pennyfeather's heart. Wants me to read law. Says I was cut out for that. More mud, more crocodiles. 5 April. Wild spring, scudding clouds. Oh, life! Dark stream of swirling bog water on which apple trees have cast down their delicate flowers. Eyes of girls among the leaves. Girls demure and romping. All fair or auburn, no dark ones. They blush better. Hoopla! 6 April. Certainly she remembers the past. Lynch says all women do. Then she remembers the time of her childhood, and mine if I was ever a child. The past is consumed in the present, and the present is living only because it brings forth the future. Statues of women, if Lynch be right, should always be fully draped, one hand of the woman feeling regretfully her own hinder parts. 6 April, later. Michael Robartes remembers forgotten beauty, and when his arms wrap her round, he presses in his arms the loveliness which has long faded from the world. Not this, not at all. I desire to press in my arms the loveliness which has not yet come into the world. 10 April. Faintly, under the heavy night, through the silence of the city, which has turned from dreams to dreamless sleep, as a weary lover whom no caress move, the sound of hoofs upon the road. Not so faintly now as they come near the bridge, and in a moment as they pass the darkened windows, the silence is cloven by alarm as by an arrow. They are heard now far away, hoofs that shine amid the heavy night as gems, hurrying beyond the sleeping fields. To what journey's end? What heart? Bearing what tidings? 11 April. Read what I wrote last night. Vague words for a vague emotion. Would she like it? I think so. Then I should have to like it also. 13 April. The Tundish has been on my mind for a long time. I looked it up and find it English, and good old blunt English, too. Damn the Dean of Studies and his funnel. What does he come here for, to teach us his own language or to learn it from us? Damn him one way or the other. 14 April. John Alphonsus Mulrennan has just returned from the west of Ireland. European and Asiatic papers, please copy. He told us he met an old man there in a mountain cabin. Old man had red eyes and short pipe. Old man spoke Irish. Mulrennan spoke Irish. Then old man and Mulrennan spoke English. Mulrennan spoke to him about universe and stars. Old man sat, listened, smoked, spat, then said, "Ah, there must be terrible queer creatures at the latter end of the world." I fear him. I fear his red-rimmed horny eyes. It is with him I must struggle all through this night till day come, till he or I lie dead, gripping him by the sinewy throat till what? Till he yields to me? No, I mean him no harm. 15 April. Met her today point blank in Grafton Street. The crowd brought us together. We both stopped. She asked me why I never came. Said she had heard all sorts of stories about me. This was only to gain time. Asked me, was I writing poems? About whom? I asked her. This confused her more, and I felt sorry and mean. Turned off that valve at once, and opened the spiritual heroic refrigerating apparatus, invented and patented in all countries by Dante Alighieri. Talked rapidly of myself and my plans. In the midst of it, unluckily, I made a sudden gesture of a revolutionary nature. I must have looked like a fellow throwing a handful of peas into the air. People began to look at us. She shook hands a moment after and, in going away, said she hoped I would do what I said. Now I call that friendly, don't you? Yes, I liked her today. A little or much? Don't know. I liked her, and it seems a new feeling to me. Then, in that case, all the rest, all that I thought, and all that I felt, all the rest before now, in fact. Oh, give it up, old chap, sleep it off. 16 April. Away, away! The spell of arms and voices, the white arms of roads, their promise of close embraces, and the black arms of tall ships that stand against the moon, their tale of distant nations. They are held out to say, "We are alone, come." And the voices say with them, "We are your kinsmen." And the air is thick with their company as they call to me, their kinsmen, making ready to go, shaking the wings of their exultant and terrible youth. 26 April. Mother is putting my new second-hand clothes in order. She prays now, she says, that I may learn in my own life and away from home and friends what the heart is and what it feels. Amen, so be it. Welcome, O life! I go to encounter for the millionth time the reality of experience, and to forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race. 27 April. Old father, old artificer, stand me now and ever in good stead. Dublin, 1904. Trieste, 1914. I think that tells us when the book was started and finished. Took quite a while. Thank you for listening to A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce, which I guess technically is a Liberty Lit production, even though I haven't put it on Liberty Lit yet. Maybe I will. Anywho, hope you'll check out my reading of Ulysses by James Joyce, which is a sequel of sorts to A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man.